Hey folks, just a reminder, you're listening to the free 40-minute or so podcast of Ring of Fire Radio, but we do a lot more every week. In fact, we do three times the amount of content. You're missing interviews, you're missing more conversations about the news every week, but there's a good news. You can get more of it. And in fact, not only can you get more of it, but you can help support this program. Radio has bottomed out, ladies and gentlemen. So we're not supporting this show through horrible gold ads or whatever it is that they have on AM Talk Radio. We're supporting this show because listeners like you become members of the Ring of Fire podcast. You can go to rofpodcast.com and sign up today. And when you sign up, not only will you get three times the show that you're getting now, but you'll also make sure that we can stick around and support this program. Every now and then we give you content in addition to that three-hour show. But folks, I know you're going to enjoy it, and I know you want to help us out. Go to rofpodcast.com right now. Thanks. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, David Dayan from the American Prospect will be here to discuss the coronavirus impacts on Wall Street and how middlemen are destroying the prescription drug market. Amanda Littman from the organization Run for Something will lay out their strategic plans to help elect women, people of color, young folk, and LGBTQ candidates. Heather Digby Parton will be here to run down a massive week in the news. And Will Parrish from The Intercept will tell us the story of how a Canadian energy company bought a small-town sheriff's unit in Oregon. You listening to this on the radio right now? Well, you should know that there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. And there's also a member show. You can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show free of commercials and access to over a decade of our archives. You can go to rofpodcast.com to sign up. Help me run down the most important stories of the week. Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So, Heather, a lot to talk about. A lot to talk about. We weren't here last week. Talk about some of the things that's happened not only in the 2020 Democratic primary race, but what's happening in terms of the health of the nation, both literally in terms of our readiness to deal with what seems to be a growing global pandemic, but also the health of the nation in terms of how it's doing in maintaining the rule of law and the institutions that are supposedly set up to make sure that we have a government that remains democratic, at least to some degree, at least in theory, right? And one in which the apparatus of the U.S. government is not used for explicit political and financial ends of the president. So let's start with the debate, since that's the sort of freshest in people's minds. Of course, we are now talking, we're, you know, less than 24 hours away from what's happening in South Carolina. That is, of course, the South Carolina primary. My sense is, relative to the Nevada debate, this one's not going to change things too much in terms of a trajectory. In many ways, this debate was a waste, if you ask me.
Yeah, I mean, I guess so. I'm not sure what you mean by that, to be honest. I think, I think you're right about the trajectory. It seems to be pretty clear that unless something really dramatic happens, and, you know, who knows, maybe it will, but at this point, it seems unlikely. that we're heading for. I mean, it's going to be a long slog. I think people are going to stay in the race. I don't think that, you know, you're going to have somebody dominating. You're going to have Sanders dominating to such an extent that it's overwhelming, and that, you know, that he will be alone after Super Tuesday. But he's going to be gathering a lot of delegates over the next month or so, and it's going to be fairly obvious unless, as I said, something dramatic happens. The debate, though, I still think it was a waste in the sense that, you know,
wasted opportunity in my mind, I think.
That for sure. Wasted opportunity because there's so much to talk about aside from this. And part of this is the moderators, you know, in these debates tend to be just stuck on these same, you know, they want to get these grudge matches going. I guess this is part, or they're just uninformed about what's really going on in the world. I mean, they didn't ask one question about the coronavirus, and, or I guess they did ask one, but it was very much in passing. And frankly, the candidates didn't jump on it either, as they should have, because this is something that is very much on people's minds. And I think people would have liked to have heard what they had to have to say about that. And there's such a huge critique of the Trump administration and their lack of attention and lack of funding for public health, and particularly these kinds of public health emergencies, that they really missed that opportunity to make a very strong point about how, you know, basically dangerous the Trump administration is on this topic. And, you know, they didn't take the time to, you know, talk about the assault on the rule of law, as you mentioned. And the way that Trump has completely, you know, I mean, now his vengeance tour has taken on, you know, really sinister aspects to it with the appointment of some of the people that he's put in. We can talk about that later. But, you know, this was, I think, in that sense, you're absolutely right, a missed opportunity. Instead of grinding out this repetitive sort of argument that we've seen now for, what has it been, 6 months that we've been watching these debates, you know, it's long past time for the candidates and the media to shift into a different mode and to stop, you know, and of course, you know, the horse race aspect of it, which is inevitable to some degree, but they don't need to pump it quite as hard as they do. You know, let's all, you know, you hear Mr. So-and-so, you attack so-and-so, and setting it up like that, it's getting very tedious. So you're right. You know, they could be using these debates as a way to inform the public about what is important, what the differences are between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party and these candidates individually and the President of the United States, and that's not happening. So, you know, here we are, and we're not at the end of it. There are a bunch more debates. So, you know, right. Hopefully they will start to see the handwriting on the wall, that they're going to start losing interest if they don't, you know, step it up and stop having the same argument over and over again.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we can sort of dig into some of the specifics, because there were some, you know, moments that I think were relevant. I mean, I think the by waste, I meant like a wasted opportunity for all of the candidates in some respect. I think share a similar perspective to at least some of the candidates on stage, that Mike Bloomberg is a fundamentally different type of candidate than the rest are. I mean, I have obviously my and you do too. Obviously, our favorites, but Mike Bloomberg, I think, represents a threat that extends beyond his policies. You know, in terms of, you know, what we consider to be a functioning democracy and a functioning Democratic party. Because of how he's entered this race, it's been fascinating. And now, you know, we can take a sort of more of like a, I guess, a 10-day perspective on this. All the candidates hammered Mike Bloomberg. He had been sort of safely cocooned in hundreds of millions of dollars. I think it's $350 million. It could be more.
Campaign. Closer to half a billion now.
$500 million ad campaign. And, you know, he was like a bar of soap that, you know, had no competitors, essentially, in terms of these advertisements. And he said that he smelled very good and cleaned you up nicely and had the proper pH balance, I guess. And essentially what happened with the debate is that people came on stage, and I have to say that, you know, Elizabeth Warren is like the only thing I can compare it to is like Mariano Rivera to the Red Sox back in his heyday, came in and really slaughtered him in both debates. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. But what it was the functional equivalent of people, you know, following up that soap ad with, oh, incidentally, you should know, it's been tainted with lead and mercury. It causes a rash and has been linked to, several diseases, just so you know about that soap. And the public has reacted appropriately. Yeah. We got to take a quick break. We'll be back to talk more about the specifics of the debate and get a sense of what we would like them to have seen. We'll talk more about the coronavirus, not just as a phenomenon in itself, but what it could have meant to the Democratic candidates at really the peak, I think, of interest in Democratic debates. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. Be right back with Digby. Hey folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You gotta check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Digby. So Heather, we started to get into some of the details of the debate. I mean, we talked about, I think, a lot of things that were lacking there, at least broadly speaking, in terms of both from a moderator perspective, and I'm with you. I would like to see the debates decommodified. You know, no longer can they be run by the networks because they end up just using it as an advertisement for their, you know, their own like stars. Rather, you know, let's get another organization like the League of Women Voters, have them do the debates. If the networks want to bid to who gets to carry it, that's fine, but they don't get to do the backdrop. They don't get to pick the moderators. None of that is the way that we should be doing this. That may be a pipe dream at this day and age, but I think a smaller group of moderators who do all the debates would have that sense of like, we've covered this ground.
Yeah.
And we need to make a sort of like a narrative arc here with what we're doing. But, I don't think we don't have that. And that's what it is, but let's talk about what did happen over the course of the two debates. I think the most prominent thing that happened was that Michael Bloomberg lost about $300 million worth of value to his advertising, which is so grotesque. I mean, I'm happy about that, but the idea is so grotesque where that money could have gone. And the irony is that I think he got in to stop Warren and Sanders. And what he's done is stopped Joe Biden. Joe Biden might have, stopped himself in some way, but I think he's really drawn from Joe Biden in many respects. And so there you have it. I mean, I think like you said earlier, I mean, it looks like Bernie Sanders is, you know, I think it's a little bit early to make this proclamation, but I think he's got an 80-85% chance of winning this nomination, which isn't to say that people should be dropping out at this point. I can understand a lot of reasons why people would stay in, frankly. But it doesn't appear that they're going to coalesce around anybody, or that the voters are coalescing around anybody, in a way that that he can be challenged, at least in terms of getting a plurality of the votes in the delegates.
Well, I agree with that. And as for Bloomberg, I think, you know, it's funny, I had a conversation with somebody who was flipping out with me about Bloomberg. This was just before the Nevada caucuses. You know, crazy. We've got to do everything we can to stop him. This is awful. And, you know, I understand the impulse, of course, because you're absolutely right. I mean, Bloomberg is not, he is completely wrong for the Democratic Party in this, at this particular moment. I mean, I'm not sure that he ever would have been someone who would be right, but certainly not now. I mean, it's just, it's a ridiculous thing. And if he were to have been able to buy the nomination, which is essentially what he's trying to do, it would have caused a civil war in the Democratic Party. I mean, Sanders, you know, there's a slight risk of Sanders having a similar, or at least a somewhat, you know, comparable sort of effect in some ways, but nothing compared to Bloomberg. And the idea that he has, you know, spent all of this money, and the conversation I was having with someone, you know, they were flipping out and sending me all this oppo and all this stuff, you know, I'm going, hey, you know, my feeling from the very beginning was, you know what, people in this country have never seen Mike Bloomberg. You people right. from New York, and I said this to you before, you know him very well. You know what kind of a person he is. Wait until people see him. He is an arrogant, wealthy, domineering, conservative know-it-all. And it that is just not going to fly. And, of course, that's exactly what happened. I mean, they went after him hard, the Democratic candidates, and Warren certainly is a hero for what she did in Nevada. But it was mostly, in my view, it's Bloomberg himself. Once you see this guy, you know, he had, you know, he was selling this nice perfumey soap, but right. once you saw him there, you could smell the fact that this guy was actually very, very toxic. And I think he, the, you know, it's an interesting experiment to see whether or not somebody could buy an election, whether somebody yep. could come in with this unlimited amount of money. And you know what? I mean, the old, you know, money can't buy you love. Well, you know, it can't, apparently, because this guy, he is who he is. And no amount of money could hide that when he was yep. up there like a, you know, a regular candidate. And so, you know, I think that we need to, when all this said, the smoke is cleared and the election's over and, you know, hopefully a Democrat is in the White House, we're going to have to step back and think about this a little bit, about the effect of money and what it really means and how we fight it and how we deal with it. Because money alone, he's proving, and Steyer too, for that matter, is not enough.
Yes, and I'll tell you what's really disturbing. I mean, obviously, and not only would he have created a civil war in the Democratic Party, and would have, I think, sort of radicalized people who, you know, are not radical. I think we would have never had a non-billionaire again as a nominee. I mean, once the path was shown that, like, you can come in and buy, like, the most unlikable guy can be sold.
Sheldon with Adelson for president.
I mean, exactly. You know, that would have been the implications of this. And so that is encouraging. He, in many respects, did the opposite of what I think he intended to do, in terms of like knocking out, Sanders. I think, frankly, he paved the way for Sanders. I mean,
he
this is,
him.
You know,
and
we shall see. Where that ends up landing, I mean, I guess, I don't know, you know, how much he's going to put into the races. He certainly made a lot of people wealthy, though, not relative to him, but, you know, there's a lot of consultants out there and there's a lot of politicians who had their pet projects. I mean, he paid a lot of money to a lot of people to get endorsements and elected. We should also add, though, as Elizabeth Warren pointed out this week, he also made it possible for the Republicans to regain the Senate. And we know what that ended up doing by funding people like Lindsey Graham and Pat Toomey. He also gave $3 or $4 million to Rick Snyder the year before Rick Snyder ended up poisoning thousands in Flint, Michigan. I mean, so Michael Bloomberg, that sword swings both ways. We need to take a break. In the next hour, let's talk a little bit more about what the Democratic candidates could have said in terms of the coronavirus from a political standpoint. And then we should also talk about what they could have said about what's happening with the Department of Justice and Donald Trump's sort of like revenge tour, as you call it. We're going to take a quick break. I'll be back in a moment. Digby will join me in the next hour. This is Ring of Fire Radio, and I'm Sam Cedar. Coming up, the American prospect's David Dayan with the real story behind the coronavirus threat. I'm Sam Cedar. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, Sam Cedar here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a five-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. The coronavirus has been making news for the last few weeks with stories of the disease spreading to countries outside of China. Here to tell us what the most dangerous part of the coronavirus is, David Dayan from the American Prospect. So, David, we'll have other conversations about sort of the political implications of the coronavirus. They are in some ways defined by what the realities of what the coronavirus will do. But they're also, they also center around, the anxiety. And one of the things that the coronavirus, it appears to be doing is not just, I think, shining a light on the general incompetence of the Trump administration and their defunding of our ability to respond from a health perspective and from a logistical perspective. It is shining light on the relationship the United States has with the rest of the world in terms of relying on them for all sorts of products that we use in our daily life that we really have no awareness of where it comes from or what's involved with it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the attacks on Trump from the left on the sort of incompetence and the various cuts to pandemic response programs need to be tempered a little bit, because for 40 years, we've had this bipartisan initiative to outsource our manufacturing base to not just other countries abroad, but largely to one country abroad, and that would be China, and to centralize the supply chain for just about everything in this one region of the world. And it's not just that it was China. It could have been any country in the world. When you centralize the supply and make sure, have a situation where your product lines are all coming from one place, then any shock to the system in that one location is going to be incredibly magnified. So this is not about just China per China. This is about the concentration of the outsourcing in general. And what it created is exactly what we're seeing. So large sections of China have been shut down, put on quarantine. Workers don't want to go back to the factories because they fear catching the virus. And production has basically shut down in large parts of China. Wuhan is a big manufacturing region. It's almost like the Detroit of China, what Detroit was in the 1960s.
Right.
And when you do that, especially with the way in which logistics works these days, with just-in-time shipping and component parts made in one part of the world and moved to another manufacturing location and put into another part, it's not just the finished goods coming out of China, but those components, those intermediate goods that then don't get to a factory somewhere else in the world. And that factory needs to shut down or slow production. And so you can see how this just absolutely cascades all over the world, and it's going to lead to shortages. I mean, we're going to see it. This is baked in already. You can't just shut down production for a month and not expect consequences.
There's a lot to unpack there, and I should say that, you know, I'm a little gadget lover, and you know, on like a Kickstarter and Indiegogo, those type of things, you get these emails, and I look at the gadgets, and there's like a thing that will inflate your bike tires, and it's handheld, and you know, they're doing the production in China, and then all of a sudden I get an email that, look, we were expecting delivery in January of 2020. But the factories have been shut down for 2 or 3 months. We don't know when they're getting back in, and so this is going to slow things down. Well, this is this little specialty product. It's not going to mean much to me, but everything that's happening to that my little handheld bike pump is also happening to products that we use every single day. And
yeah,
just to,
and
you know,
you know, that was policy. That wasn't just some unseen force and hand at the market that just dictated that the Chinese were better at making stuff than any other place on earth. This was concerted policy to allow multinationals to seek the lowest common denominator, the cheapest labor costs, and the places where the logistics was most built up, and move all of their production and all of their factories there. And there was a danger to that. Nobody sort of added in the hidden costs that we're seeing right now with supply shocks, and how that will, you know, rebound all over this country and the world.
Right.
We made a policy to stop producing in America, that we would be a service-oriented, consumer-oriented economy, and now we are at risk because of that fateful decision.
All right, and I want to dig into that in a moment. So what we have here is a situation where we have sort of the classic problem of having all your eggs in one basket. And then we have
right.
an additional problem that basket, it's unclear what happens in that basket because of the nature of the government that we're talking about, China. And there's a whole host of other complications that are a function, you
well,
know, that
and,
are problematic
and
about the basket. But the main problem is we put all the eggs in the basket. And I want to get to why we did this. Like, I understand why, like, when you say this was a policy, I mean, clearly this was a decision by individual corporations to say, like, where can we go to get the cheapest labor? What did the government, what did the U.S. government do to A, discourage that, or B, encourage it?
Well, they absolutely encouraged it. I can tell you from personal experience, my father worked in the textile industry. And in 1978, 1979, he went to Washington, one and only time he lobbied. He went with a group of other textile manufacturers to talk to people in Washington about the loss of their industry. And they told him flat out, we are giving up this industry for the benefit of world peace. And what they meant was that this was a low-skill profession that they could move abroad and give hope and opportunity to some other country that then would not be engaged in civil unrest because its people would have at least some industry within it. So we willingly, the government willingly allowed this to happen, allowed multinationals to move their operations abroad before, you know, when my father did that in the 1970s, there were hundreds of sweater mills within the Philadelphia area where I grew up. Now there are zero. And that was a policy choice that the United States made to rid ourselves of the textile industry. And that was replicated on and on and on down the line. And it went into things that we should not give up for the basis of self-sufficiency and, in some cases, national security. And we're talking about weapon systems, and we're talking about the real danger with respect to coronavirus, which is all of the pharmaceuticals and medical supplies that are made in China and elsewhere.
Okay, I want to take a break. I want to come back. I want to talk about that. But I also, I want to ask you, and you'll answer it when we return. One, how sincere were government policymakers at that time that essentially the exportation of these manufacturing industries was a function of helping the world as opposed to simply helping multinational corporations find the cheapest way of exploiting labor? And the other question I have for you is, like, how could the government have interceded or not encouraged that behavior or discouraged it? And then we'll also talk about a piece that you've written in the American Prospect specifically about the prescription drug markets. There have been reports I saw over the course of this week that at least 100, the CDC has a list of at least 150 drugs, including antibiotics, that we aren't going to see, that we're going to have shortages of. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with David Dayan. After this, I'm Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio.
Close your eyes and clone yourself. Build your heart an army to defend your innocence while you do everything wrong. Don't be scared to walk alone.
Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a 5-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours pouring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to David Dayan about his piece in the American Prospect, Behind the Coronavirus Threat, a Middleman Destroying Prescription Drug Markets. So, David, in the last segment, you were walking us through the dilemma that we now face because of decisions that were made 40 years ago by the U.S. government in some way to encourage or not to discourage the outsourcing of our manufacturing capacity for a whole host of industries, including, you said, in your dad's case, the textile business, but also dealing with drugs and vaccinations and whatnot. And we put all our eggs in one basket. That basket also happened to be not only be a rival, but one which was fairly obscure and less than opaque, and one which, you know, we are now relying upon for some of our basic goods. You've also told us that it's already happening. We haven't felt the shortages, but the shortages are coming because it's like, you know, the rat, as it were, has not made its way through the snake, but it is already in the mouth. It's already being digested. We are at the tail and we just haven't, we don't realize it's coming yet. And that is, of course, these shortages. First off, answer that question I asked at the end of the last segment. How sincere were the government officials who told your dad when he went there and to save the textile business outside of Philadelphia that they were doing this to help these other countries? And what could the government have done to stop corporations from going to where the lowest labor costs were?
I mean, I don't think they were sincere at all, but ultimately that doesn't matter. They made the policy choice, and they could have obviously made a different choice. I mean, globalization was not preordained. It was not a necessary precondition. I mean, the sort of neoliberal ideology suggests that it is, but the Ricardian comparative advantage is not a suicide pact. We didn't have to do this. We knew that there were going to be huge consequences for this on our domestic manufacturing base, on large segments of the country, of millions of people's lives, all the jobs that we ended up losing from industry and what that did to the fabric of these communities. We knew all that was going to be troublesome, and we didn't create nearly any enough assistance or adjust trade adjustment assistance, things like that, to compensate for that. We just went and did it, and it had terrible consequences on its own. I mean, that thing is something we should say, like, you know, the loss of millions of jobs in America from manufacturing is a problem in and of itself. Now, the lengthening and concentration of the supply chain was a separate problem that introduced risk into the system. But this would have been bad even if we outsourced to 30 countries, right? This would have been a problematic for the winners and losers and a great many losers that it created. But what could have been done differently? I mean, there are tons of I have heard since 2004 this whole concept that we're going to stop incentivizing outsourcing. Every Democratic campaign since at least then has said, we're going to stop incentivizing outsourcing. Well, we've obviously haven't stopped since they keep running the same ad that says we're going to stop it. And this has been government policy for roughly 40 years now. So there were definitely ways where we could have discouraged this stampede out of this country from the standpoint of manufacturing, but we chose not to.
We only have about 5 minutes left now. I want to get to the piece that you wrote in terms of, you know, that touches on the shortage of drugs that we're going to have. Drugs, and we don't really know exactly which drugs we won't have and when, do we, at this point?
Well, it goes beyond drugs, first of all. I mean, the largest segment of surgical masks, which are, you know, a way to stop respiratory diseases like this from spreading, come out of China. We know that penicillin and antibiotics and ibuprofen, all of these basic generic drugs, all come out of China, and more to the point, the active pharmaceutical ingredients that are used to manufacture prescription drugs all over the world, about 80% of those come from China and India. And even that which comes from India gets part of its component parts from China. So we are very reliant as a world on China for these medications. And the question is why? And the answer has a lot to do with the way that these generic drugs are contracted and sold, particularly to hospitals. So there are these bulk buying groups known as group purchasing organizations, or GPOs, that purchase on behalf of hospital chains, and many hospital chains sort of agglomerated together. And the idea is intuitive, right? I mean, you know, you have to buy these various supplies or various drugs and probably get a better price if you buy 1,000 of them than if you buy one at a time. So that's the idea behind it. However, the way that that market is structured, it incentivizes, one, higher costs for these drugs and these supplies, and two, it creates a system where the group purchasing organizations are paid by the suppliers, and they have to give up large portions of their percentage margin to the suppliers in order to get the market share. We only have four major buying groups, four major GPOs across the country that service all of the hospitals, the $300 billion in purchasing. And so if you get one of those contracts, you're in business. And if you don't, you can't stay in business. So that has concentrated and harmed the proliferation of a generic drug industry. And then you have to pay so much to buy that access that you have to reduce those costs somewhere else down the chain. So it's almost impossible to create prescription drugs in the United States, given the labor and environmental standards that we have, because there's literally no money in it. So this incentivized the move of this entire industry into the hands of places like China.
Interesting. And so we have a geographic problem now in terms of the concentration of what we rely on. And it sort of came out of a concentration of just sort of like a, you know, a corporate concentration that led to this geographic concentration. And we have the same problem twice over, as it were.
Right. It was a kind of a messed up market structure that incentivized these middlemen to skim large amounts of money out of the top of the transaction and made it so that the only way to survive as a generic drug maker is to move abroad, number one. And number two, it locked the hospitals and the providers into buying from these groups. Most of these GPO contracts say you not only are buying this year from this generic drug manufacturer, you have to keep buying from them next year or the year after or the year after. You're going to get these huge penalties. And so when there's a supply shock from that one manufacturer, the hospitals have nowhere else to go. And the dirty secret here, and what coronavirus is actually going to mask, is that there have been persistent drug shortages in the generic industry, these very old line, sterile injectables, just normal drugs that are used in hospitals. These have been persistent for about a decade. Wow. There are currently 145 drugs in shortage, and it's because of this GPO system. And in a way, that's going to get bailed out by the coronavirus, because everyone's going to think, oh, well, there was this problem in China, and that's the reason why we have all these drug shortages. No, we've had them. We've been enduring them for a long period of time, and it's because this market is completely broken.
Would seem like something that you would want to see some congressional hearings about. Maybe we will. David Dayan, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
David Dayan is the executive editor of The American Prospect. He is the best-selling author of the book Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. When we come back, Heather Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week that's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show and hear what you've been missing.
Used to spend my nights out in ballroom. Liquor was the only love I'd known.
Hey, folks. It's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You gotta check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.